Yeah.
Right. This session is for the RIP Act, the anti-terrorism bill in England, and is going to be in English. Everyone in the right place, or not? Okay, we'll make a start. My name is Casper Bowden, and I'm director of an NGO in England called the Foundation for Information Policy Research. And first of all, I'd like to thank Andy Miller-Magoon for inviting me to talk to Chaos Computer Conference. We are an NGO that's been going for about 3 years, and I suppose the group of people behind FIPR got to know each other campaigning about key escrow from about 1996-97. Now, I was going to assume that everybody here knew what key escrow was, but talking to the people in the cafeteria at lunch, the language may not be familiar. So if who here knows what key escrow is? Okay. Well, not everybody. Escrow is the term in English for the concept of government passing a law to require everyone to stockpile their decryption keys in some humongous government database, with the supposed intention that if emails are intercepted, the government will still be able to understand them because they will have the decryption key. This proposal is now pretty much dead in the water across the world, but it was a very active subject of campaigning, particularly in the United States from the early 90s, and particularly in Britain between about 1996 and 1999, when the UK government abandoned the idea. FIPR is independent of government. We're funded by industry donations and from private individuals. We're governed by a board of trustees, and we have an advisory council of about 30 people who are experts in e-commerce law, human rights law, civil liberties, computer science, computer security, and related fields. I'm going to talk today about some UK legislation, and I suppose the immediate question is why might that be of interest to a German audience? And I think the short answer is that Britain, unfortunately, has been in the lead of arguing at European level for the most drastic surveillance laws. Britain now has, as I hope will become clear, the most drastic surveillance law in the world with the RIP Act, which I'll mainly be talking about. But it's also actively engaged in arguing at the European level for proposals such as mandatory data retention and, who knows, perhaps encryption controls in the future as well. George Donezis, I thought, gave an excellent presentation this morning about the technical reason why data retention is important, even if traffic is encrypted. To begin at the beginning, I suppose I have to give you some background about the legal position in England about interception of communications, and particularly telephone communications. The last phone tapping law before the RIP Act was in 1985, and it was called the Interception of Communications Act, and it established a framework whereby telephone interception, that is to say accessing the content of the conversation, is authorised by a politician, by the Interior Minister, who we call Home Secretary. And there are about 2,000 interception warrants issued each year, and the purposes for which interception can be authorised are national security, for prevention or detection of serious crime, meaning something which can go to prison for more than 3 years, or what is called economic well-being, which is essentially economic intelligence gathering. The main agencies that do interception are the police, who now operate through a national organisation which is almost like a miniature FBI, called the National Criminal Intelligence Service, and they're tasked primarily with serious crime, drugs trafficking, and the most serious crimes of criminal investigation. The Security Service, or MI5, who are, if you like, the Interior Counterintelligence Agency, and GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters, which I think many of you will know collaborate with the National Security Agency in the US in a global eavesdropping network called Echelon, that has been the subject of much controversy over the past few years. The law which was passed in 1985 didn't explicitly apply to the internet because obviously the internet hadn't really been invented, or at least it was scarcely understood as such at that time. But it would in theory apply. The law was adequate to cover internet providers. But the police decided, and GCHQ also decided, that they wanted a much more all-embracing law for reasons which I'll come on to. When Key Escrow in Britain was abandoned, the law was never formally proposed, but the idea was eventually shot down intellectually after a great sort of running battles with various government departments. When Key Escrow was abandoned in 1990, the sort of stage was set for a new all-encompassing interception law, which became known as the RIP Act, or Regulation of Investigatory Powers. And it became law in 2000, after about 4 or 5 months extremely heated debate in Parliament. But the most controversial part of it hadn't yet been implemented. In other words, the commencing order to say this law, although it's in the statute book, is actually now in effect, that hasn't yet happened for the most sensitive parts. There are three parts of the Act which are of interest to us. The first part is to do with interception of email, that is accessing the content. The second part is to do with traffic data. And the third part is to do with encryption. For interception, the main effect of the new legislation is that it can require internet service providers to install what the press have dubbed a black box. And a black box is simply a generic name for any device that will allow an internet provider to relay, in an extreme case, the full IP stream of any particular customer's IP traffic. Or, under the widest and most literal construction of the law, potentially all its customers' traffic. That is to say, the entire pipe that the ISP handles, the sum total of all its IP traffic, could, in principle, have to be relayed to a new monitoring centre. The monitoring centre is going to be based in the building of the Domestic Security Service, MI5, and the picture, I suppose, is of a sort of spider's web with the MI5 building at its centre and then feeder cables spreading out potentially to an unknown number of internet service providers. We don't know how many internet service providers are actually going to be instructed to install black boxes. The government is saying not very many and only the largest, but the power is there to require anyone to install the black box. The conditions under which a warrant for interception can be granted haven't changed. They're still national security, serious crime, and economic intelligence gathering. The system of issuing warrants has changed slightly in that previously warrants were on a particular telephone number, on a particular physical address, street address. The warrant system now specifies the named person. And any communication, whether that's by email, telephone, or pager, to or from that person is thereby covered. So, in terms of the gross number of warrants issued, we expect to see a fall in the number of warrants, but exactly whether or not that reflects the same degree of interception or greater degree of interception, it's difficult to map one onto the other. The oversight of interception is provided by a person called the Interception Commissioner. And he is a retired judge who has the job of overseeing all of the warrants, whether the telephone or internet or anything else, that are issued in a year. And every year he writes a short report, which is published by Parliament. And that report has a sort of public half and a secret half, which isn't published. The reports now have been published for about sort of 15 years, including those for the previous interception legislation. And they always tend to follow the same format, which is not containing anything very controversial or exciting, and some would say making a great song and dance about criticising a particular agency for getting, say, one digit of a telephone number wrong. But we do have great concerns about whether a single judge, without any technical staff, particularly without the independent technical assistance, is actually going to be able to keep track of the degree of internet surveillance that is now going to be enabled. Now, I mentioned that the warrants were essentially unchanged, and that is true, but it's important to understand that in Britain there are two kinds of warrant. There is the kind that I mentioned, which is what most people would understand by a warrant, and that it names a particular person. But there is also what you might call the Troy warrant, or National Security warrant, or GCHQ warrant. And this is the warrant which we believe is used to authorise interception of communications by the Echelon system. In other words, that enables all communications to be trawled according to perhaps the keywords in the content, or perhaps according to criteria which are a mixture of the kind of traffic analysis that George was talking about and keywords. And that is the sort of business that intelligence agencies engage in. Now, one of the main constitutional worries about the new Act is that it seems to break down the previous distinction between surveillance of domestic communications and surveillance of foreign communications for intelligence. And the reason for that is that if you have interception of internet communications done by black boxes stationed at internet service providers, then the only possible way one could think of distinguishing between foreign traffic and domestic traffic would be some sort of mass filtration system based on the IP address. That might be technically possible, and I'd be very interested to discuss with those people who know in the audience about the situation in Germany. When we gave evidence to the European Parliament inquiry into the Echelon system recently, I understood from the chairman of that, Gerhard Schmidt, that in Germany, perhaps your intelligence agencies do attempt to distinguish foreign and domestic traffic in this way. But in any case, in Britain, this isn't going to happen. So there are loopholes in the application of these trawling warrants, which means that effectively all domestic communications could also be caught. And there is no requirement to, as it were, not use or turn a blind eye from any domestic communications that are caught in this way. The second part of the RIP Act is to do with traffic data. And this was very well defined by George this morning, but in case anyone wasn't here for that. This is data about who is talking to who, or which machine is talking to which machine, rather than content of communications. And obviously that's a problematic concept for the internet, because internet protocols operate in layers. So what is traffic at one layer is going to be the content at a different layer. Nevertheless, there is a very cumbersome and almost incomprehensible definition in the legislation of what traffic data means, and it certainly appears to cover such things as mobile phone location data, the email address that you might send to and fro. But there's a question, for example, about when you access a web page. In most cases, if you have a static web page and you know the full URL, then you know precisely the content that somebody has been looking at, because you know the page that they've been looking at. And in the original definition of the legislation, it was not clear, but it was likely, that the full URL would have been counted as traffic data. So we made quite a stir about this in the press, and our argument was that if there is traffic data that in fact is tantamount almost the same thing as content, or tells you what the content might be, then you should need a full interception warrant to see that, because otherwise you're greatly expanding the powers for the police. The other thing to say about traffic data in the RIP Act is that the purposes for which traffic data can be accessed are much broader than that with interception. Traffic data can be accessed for any minor crime, for public order offences, including demonstrations, for tax, health and safety, I'm forgetting one crucial purpose, which we'll come back to anyway, but it's extremely broad. The other point about traffic data is that no warrant is required. The police can go and get traffic data in any quantity on their own authority. So they could go and access traffic data on one person, or 100 people, or 5 million people, potentially. The only restriction is the police's own estimation of what is proportionate. And this goes back to the use of the term proportionality in the European Convention of Human Rights, which I'll talk about later. The problem is that there is no, as it were, scale for the police to know what is proportionate. And the police obviously have very little experience in application of this law. So what we fear is that we may see very, very different standards applied to what the police consider proportionate in a particular case. And because there is no transparency, because the only oversight of this is via the commissioner, who operates in secret, primarily, then there's no, as it were, public transparency to check any irregularities that may occur. The third part of the RIP Act is to do with encryption. And when the concept of key escrow died in 1999, the police and the intelligence agencies, in this case primarily the police, the National Criminal Intelligence Service, sort of virtually gave an ultimatum to government that the only acceptable substitute for them was a power to demand any person's decryption key or password. It applies equally to access passwords as well. And the problem with this concept is people genuinely forget their passwords or have their keys destroyed accidentally or deliberately as part of key management all the time. So what happens if the police arrive and say, we would like this key which you were using a year ago? And you say, well, I'm sorry, I've rolled that key over, it's destroyed. Or you say, well, that's actually a password protecting the key, and I changed that last month, and I simply don't remember what it is. In that case, the power that the police originally wanted was that you could only escape conviction and go into jail for 2 years if you could prove that you didn't have possession of the key, or in the case of the password, if you could prove that you had forgotten it. So this obviously raises a question, and how do you prove you've forgotten something? Well, again, we managed to make quite a big deal about this in the media, and we finally succeeded in getting an amendment to that law, which means essentially now if you assert that you have forgotten the password or you have lost the key, then it's up to the police to somehow prove that you are lying. And that's obviously a very difficult thing for the police to do, also beyond reasonable doubt. So in fact, our argument for a long time, at least 2 years before the written bill was formulated, we were writing papers about this, and I'm sure this isn't rocket science to all of you, that the idea of demanding the power to demand a key is actually nonsensical. It doesn't really work either way. In human rights terms, it's a clear breach of the presumption of innocence guaranteed by the European Convention to say that somebody has to prove that they're innocent or effectively prove they've forgotten the key. But it's not very useful for the police to have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that somebody's lying about that, because there are very few circumstances, perhaps a very few circumstances, where it's possible to do so, but in the overwhelming majority of cases it's not useful. So I should have mentioned at the outset that because of the way the media work, we felt that the most effective way of advocating these issues to the public and to the media was not as a campaigning group, but as a think tank. And that means that our position papers are not sort of titled the campaign against this, that, or the other. We didn't run a campaign against the RIP Act. And I'm going to say a number of times in this presentation that we're not a campaigning organisation. But, in any case, when the RIP Act came along, the position was so serious that we felt we should put up a web page, and this is it. Nope, that's not it. So over here you've got the front page of one of the leading Sunday newspapers, The Observer, from, I think, June 2000. over here you've got the front page of the other major Sunday newspaper from March. This is an inside pull-out feature on the Act, which one of the leading broadsheet newspapers, The Guardian, did, and that is, you may in fact recognise from a BBC adaptation of the George Orwell novel 1984, and that is the face of the Home Secretary at the time. And here's some of the... I'm sorry? Oh, right. Here you've got some of the radio and occasional TV pieces of coverage that we've got. And the main news section on this website is down here. We stopped updating it in April, but it goes on and on and on and on and on. And eventually we generated over 1,000 news items, both online and in the press and on the radio. And in terms of newspaper coverage, I'm afraid this is offline, so we can't see the newspaper logos, but altogether there are about 11 national broadsheet newspapers, including Sunday newspapers in Britain. And these are excerpts from editorials, the opinion of the newspaper itself. And altogether there were 17 newspaper editorials spread across 11, in fact, it's to say every national newspaper, which didn't just say the RIP Act needed to be amended or changed, but called for the entire legislation to be scrapped. So in terms of legislation since in the past 30, 40 years, arguably this is the most controversial piece of legislation across the political spectrum that there's ever been. However, as you probably know, in Britain we have, the last two elections, a landslide majority for the governing party. And we have a two-system, two-chamber system of legislation, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And when one party has such a large majority in the House of Commons, it isn't really possible to change legislation significantly. But the House of Lords, there is no built-in government majority, and it is often possible to obtain quite significant concessions. And we did in this case. The two major concessions, there are about 12 more, but the two major concessions were on the point about the full URL in traffic data, and that is now amended so that there is a rider to the legislation that just about makes sense, but is still very complicated to interpret. That means effectively only the IP address of the web server can be obtained as traffic data. Certainly nothing after sort of HTTP, www.a.b, nothing after that can be obtained as traffic data. And that became known as the Big Browser Amendment. The image we tried to create was the police being able to recreate anybody's web server session from some central monitoring console simply by replicating the URL as it was captured in real time. Hence, Big Browser, Big Brother, and that idea. Now, I think that amendment will prove to be extraordinarily significant as time goes on. The other major amendment was, I've mentioned, about the burden of proof on the power to demand a key, and the fact that now, effectively, the authorities have to prove that someone who's asked for a key or a password is lying. And we believe, essentially, that that power is now probably dead, and one of the reasons why the government is taking a very long time to activate it is because they probably realise now this makes very little sense. But in theory, the activation date for that decryption power was supposed to be last summer, I mean this summer of 2001, it's now been put back at least until the summer of 2002. Similarly, the power to access traffic data is still not active, and the power that the activation of that has probably been put back until 2002 also. I'm going to switch this off because I'm using this in my speaking notes as well. One of the points of interest about the website, it's not a terribly well-designed website, you can can see, but it sort of snowballed once we began to get newspaper coverage. And I think it became a very effective example of a campaign tool. But you'll remember I told you FIDLA is not a campaign organisation. But nevertheless, it became a very useful example of a campaign tool, because these issues are phenomenally difficult to explain to the general press. And the more general, the more difficult it is to explain and to persuade them that it's going to be of interest to their readers. So, apart from individually briefing 100 or 200 journalists, what we found was a very effective way of getting the message over was once we had some stories written by journalists, which were quite reasonable in explaining what the issues were, we could then refer other journalists to those same pieces on the website, because journalists essentially cut and paste and plagiarise each other's work all the time. It's the standard modus operandi of research, is you just go to the Cussings Library, find what somebody else has written, play around with it a bit, try and get a new quote, and there you've got your story. Well, we help journalists do this. And once we found that there were about 25 or 30 stories which put the story over in the point of view that we wanted, it then became almost impossible for a journalist to write it any other way. Moreover, they would by and large get the story correct because they could write the first draft in a way that we could, as it were, help them to correct, as opposed to a first draft which previously was, I suppose, the usual standard, where the story would just be so completely wrong-headed we wouldn't even know how to begin to rewrite it. And that snowballed and snowballed and snowballed until we got up to 1,000 stories. And that, in turn, led to the pressure from the newspaper editorials. Now, all that press pressure proved to be extremely important because it allowed us in the House of Lords to be appointed as the official advisers to the opposition parties, which in turn meant that we got a seat inside the debating chamber. There is actually a spot for opposition advisers, which is opposite to the place where the civil servants normally sit and the government officials. And normally what happens, because the ministers don't understand these issues at all, is if they get in trouble during debate, the government officials will write out a little note and pass it via a man with a gold chain along to the guy in the front bench, who is the government minister, and the government minister will then say, "Ah, yes, some inspiration has reached me, and I've just realised that the answer to your question is this." Well, we were able to do the same thing, but from the opposition side. And that meant that whereas previously we had very sterile and uninformed debates in Parliament about these issues, we were able, if you like, precisely to programme, almost hacking the House of Lords, we were very precisely able to programme what the front bench politicians were going to say and put the most acute and the most devastating arguments directly to the ministers. And that is why, if one looks back at the parliamentary record, I think why these issues achieved a much higher standard of debate than we'd previously ever seen in Parliament. And that, in turn, led to the political pressure which allowed crucial votes to be taken and eventually the amendments achieved. But it's a very step-by-step process. You have to build that base of media interest. You then have to gain the trust of the front-bench politicians. And you then have to think out your debating points and your amendments very strategically to give the government the toughest possible choices. But, as I say again, FIDLA is not a campaigning organisation. What happened next was a big pause, really. Very little of the Act was implemented. There have been ongoing discussions with internet service providers about how to implement black boxes, how to authorise the disclosure of traffic data. And as far as we can tell by talking with the trade associations, these talks have gone very badly. There's very little agreement on what should be done, on how it should be done, and to make matters worse, the team of government officials who worked on the original legislation have now rotated by this normal civil service sort of career path, and there's now a new team of people in who don't really understand the legislation, or at least don't understand it as well as we do. And that is leading to further delay. But then, of course, the terrible events of September the 11th changed the whole picture. And we have had passed in the last 2 weeks a new anti-terrorism law. Most of that law is concerned with issues which are much higher profile for the general media in terms of human rights and civil liberties, particularly issues such as detention without trial and removing the right of the courts to review the decisions of the executive to exercise that power of detention without trial. But there was a very significant new power introduced in terms of data retention, traffic data retention. Although the RIP Act said that ISPs must hand over any traffic data that they log, it didn't actually say that ISPs have to log any particular data at all. That's what the new anti-terrorism law does. The anti-terrorism law can compel any ISP, in fact, it can even compel individual users running peer-to-peer clients. The law extends that broadly. If you're running Nutella, you could, in theory, have a man on your door with a piece of paper demanding that you somehow implement logging of who's making connections to your peer-to-peer clients. It appears at the moment to be a theoretical risk, but the government insisted explicitly in debate that they wanted the power that widely. So the power says that any internet service provider can be compelled to log any particular data at all. And the mechanism used to do this is very curious, because initially, the government is saying that they want voluntary agreements with internet service providers. But of course, if the internet service providers don't agree to the voluntary route, then there is behind that the power to force them to do so. And that power to force them is formulated in a particularly nasty way, because there is supposed to be in the bill, because it's supposed to be an anti-terrorism bill, an end to the emergency powers after 2 years. But in fact, when you read the legislation very closely, it doesn't say that at all. What it says, in fact, is that if the powers to compel an ISP to keep data are ever used just once, then they become permanent, and they never need to be reviewed again. They become a permanent part of the law. So it's, if you like, a sort of Damocles hanging over the whole internet industry, a form of collective punishment. If any ISP doesn't cooperate with the government, then once that power of compulsion is invoked, it becomes a permanent part of British law. What the data preservation power also says is that although, in theory, this is an anti-terrorism act, the purposes for which data can be retained by ISPs are not just national security or terrorism, but general crime, any crime, minor crime, traffic offences, dropping a piece of litter in Singapore, even if you're in England, a crime anywhere in the world can be the cause for an ISP to retain travel data. But if one thinks about it, there's a deeply illogical piece of nonsense here, because we're talking about traffic data. How on earth can an internet service provider distinguish in what it logs between data that might perhaps be relevant to national security or some sort of crime and data which isn't? The problem actually is in the RIP Act. The problem is in the RIP Act that says that whatever data ISPs can be forced to hand over, the purposes for which they can be forced to hand over that data should be limited to serious crime or terrorism or whatever. But as far as what data is collected, it really doesn't make much sense to say that you can collect this IP address for national security, but you can't collect that one because it's only related to crime. How on earth can one make that sort of distinction? Well, perhaps there is a better way of doing it, not an ideal way, but a better way of doing it, and I'll talk about that in a second. But essentially, the position, particularly of the UK law enforcement authorities, is that they regard it as absolutely essential to have stockpiled traffic data from ISPs so that they can investigate crime retrospectively, looking backwards. It isn't sufficient, in their view, to have a power which says, we suspect this person or this group of people, therefore begin logging against those people only. They want traffic data logged on the whole population all the time. Well, even though in the Anti-Terrorism Act the other human rights issues were much higher profile, against my expectation, we were invited again to be advisors to the House of Lords opposition, and we did, at the last minute, manage to win a decisive vote on data retention. It didn't have quite the effect that we wanted, because we fortunately couldn't get them to vote on the amendment we wanted them to vote on. They voted on something else instead, because they didn't quite understand what we were talking about. But what we're left with is, as law, an amendment which was a provisional amendment, and it was written literally on the back of an envelope, as a rhetorical debating point. But because of mechanics of debate and the very panicked way in legislation this legislation was passed, I won't bore you with the details. We've now got a piece of legislation here that makes almost no sense whatsoever. I'll tell you what it is. It says that ISPs can only retain traffic data either for national security or for prevention or detection of crime, any crime, which may relate directly or indirectly to national security. What on earth does that mean? I haven't the slightest idea. In a sense, there's no point looking for a deep meaning because it doesn't correspond with any known legal concept. It was literally written on the back of an envelope, but due to the confused procedures, it is now the law of the land. And what we're doing currently is commissioning a legal opinion from the best lawyers that we can find to try and relate this to data protection law and human rights law. And I suppose the next thing to say about all this general area is that it is still very controversial whether blanket traffic data retention on the whole population is lawful, because the Club of Data Protection Commissioners, the so-called Article 19 Committee, which is the group of European Data Protection Commissioners, has been saying quite explicitly for at least 2 years that they consider blanket traffic data retention on the whole population to be a breach of Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. They regard that as, in their words, disproportionate general surveillance. Irrespective of whether that data is processed or accessed in bulk, they consider that the mere retention of that data is incompatible with Article 8. There is also a big argument at the moment about a new European directive in this field. The current directive in this field is called the Telecommunications Privacy Directive. It was passed in 1997. And the wording of that is vague, as is the wording of all European directives. But that there is an exemption for which might arguably allow data retention for law enforcement purposes, for general crime purposes. But the Data Protection Commissioners have been quite consistent in interpreting that as saying that does not permit blanket data retention on the whole population. It perhaps only permits limited retention on a defined group or defined individual. And there's been an argument running all through this year about the new directive which will replace this. And this is called the Communications Privacy Directive. And it covers essentially this area and SPAM. And I won't bore you with the details, but there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes horse trading between different member states and between their respective positions on SPAM and on this data retention issue. And the latest twist in this has been that the Council of Ministers, the representative of the member state governments, have, and I have to say, really led by the UK, have succeeded in putting an amendment into Article 15 of that directive, which appears to say that data retention on the whole population is okay. But most unusually, on the same day of that Telecommunications Council meeting, the Commission responded with its own statement that, to paraphrase in my reading, says, well, you may say that that amendment says that data retention is okay, but we, the Commission, still believe that it is has to be interpreted in light of the Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms and in light of the European Convention of Human Rights. So reading between the lines, I think the Commission is saying that we still don't think, even if you pass this amendment, that it is compatible with European law. But that argument now has to be resolved through co-decision procedure, and that effectively means that the Parliament and the Council have to come to an agreement, a compromise, mediated by the Commission. And there was a meeting on this, which I should have been at if I was better at catching planes, in late November, under the auspices of the European Commission Cybercrime Forum. And for those of you there, I understand that there were quite vigorous discussions between data protection authorities and police authorities in particular. But it is unfortunately the case that the UK police authorities are leading the charge for mandatory data protection. I want to leave time for some questions, but I think the last thing to say on this at the moment is that tomorrow morning there's a meeting of activists, and it's going to be talking about trying to find a framework for through which European NGOs concerned with cyber rights and internet privacy can collaborate effectively and make united representations to European institutions. And personally, I very much welcome this, and I think it's long overdue. And I very much hope that we can find some effective way to make that cooperation work. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
My first question would be, are IP providers in the UK allowed to disclose the fact that black boxes have been installed? Can they disclose this fact to individual customers that their IP address is under surveillance?
That's an excellent question. The legal position is that if you're an ISP and you haven't had a black box fitted yet, you can advertise and you can have on your website, "We have no black box." But as soon as you do have a black box, then you're not allowed to tell people that you do. But it would be perfectly legal to have a banner on your website saying, "We have no black box," and then suddenly remove it without an explanation one day. One could also ask the same question about traffic data. Is it legal to tell customers, firstly, that you're collecting traffic data? Well, we think that that must be the case under the General Data Protection Law, which provides for subject access. However, with the very confused wording I spoke about in the anti-terrorism law, there is an argument that the government may try and run that this is now all covered by national security, and so that subject access does not apply. But we don't know what the position will be there. Whether ISPs are allowed to disclose that they have disclosed traffic data to the police, that appears to be a loophole. It appears to be lawful for them to do that. But when we raised that with meetings with the Home Office, they have sort of muttered darkly about the Official Secrets Act and possible breach of that.
Okay, thank you. Second question. What's the situation for internet cafes and public libraries, such as in Bristol, who have 50 terminals without any registration procedure to use them?
The position is that the law is drafted so broadly that anyone who fulfills the definition of a communications provider, not a public communications provider, therefore any private network, but certainly a private library, could in principle be required to log anything now under the Anti-Terrorism Act. How broadly the government actually implements that, again, we won't know, but they have the legal power to insist that internet cafes and public libraries log traffic data, certainly. As far as interception goes, it is only public internet service providers, which includes universities, for example, but you have to be offering service to the public that have to install black boxes, but yes, they could be masters.
So we should watch out for our public libraries asking for disclosing our personal information before using the internet terminal.
Absolutely.
Yet another question, a short one. What about small ISPs? You talked about this very crude legal construct where the non-cooperation of one single ISP would basically result in all ISPs being subjected to permanent surveillance. Is there a situation imaginable where one small ISP simply doesn't comply to the whole thing, and so every big ISP, such as AOL and so on, will be subjected to this law? And is there any attempt to do this?
I think that the phrasing is no accident. When we showed it to our legal team, which includes a former parliamentary draftsman, somebody who used to draft laws for the government, he said that it was the most deceptive and devious wording that he'd seen in 20 years, but he had no doubt it was intentional. Quite why they decided to do that, I think it is less likely that they want to exert, if you like, the pressure of collective punishment psychologically on the industry. I don't really think they're going to try that. I think they just wanted a way of making the powers permanent without Parliament really realising that's what they were about. As to how widely it'll be used, I'm afraid we don't know the answer. We just have to be. It is partly a question of public pressure. Providing we keep these issues to some extent, to the extent we have in the media, in the newspapers, then the government will be restrained, I think, from exercising powers as widely as the police wish.
Okay, very final question. The situation in the UK now is that you have to cooperate with the Conservatives in order to fight legislation that is basically started from the Labour government. I'm a UK resident, and I don't have the impression that the Conservatives as such have more regard to individual rights and personal freedoms than the Labour Party. It seems to be interchangeable. Whoever is in power tries to impose these laws. Does this put you in a very peculiar position, and what will be your position when the government changes, for example?
As you say, we now have to work with the Conservative opposition to ensure respect for civil liberties, and so I'm afraid, as far as your question goes, I couldn't possibly comment.
Yeah, Kasper, you've commented several times that FIPR sees itself as a think tank and not as a competing organization. Where do you see the most important interfaces to such campaigning organizations, and in what respect do you think that the impact that a think tank can have is limited by its very existence?
It's a question that I'm going to talk about more tomorrow's meeting, but I think maybe it's worth saying something about it now. And it's our belief, and I think our experience over 3 years, that paradoxically, as a think tank, you can have more influence than you can as a campaign organization. It isn't in any sense the case that as a think tank you're pulling your punches and somehow being less effective. How can that be so? Why on earth do I say that? Well, it's to do with the way the media works, particularly broadcast media. If you're trying to get an issue aired on radio current affairs programme, a television current affairs programme, they all follow the same format. What happens is there's a short film piece which is filmed outside the studio, maybe some geeks with placards sort of chanting in the street about Sklarov, say, or some other issue. And then you cut back to the studio and you have the interviewer who is the anchorman and who knows nothing about these issues. And he probably doesn't have a scientific or technical education, maybe terrified of computers. And then you have, well, either you have a debate between two sides, a campaigner and, say, somebody from the police or the government or the industry, and then the interviewer moderates. But what happens then, always, is the government and the industry know that the best way to suppress debate is simply not to turn up, not to put up a spokesperson. So what happens is the producer of the news programme has the choice between either not running the item at all or making his interviewer, his presenter, who is, you know, a vainglorious television star, run the risk of stumbling over his words and talking utter technical nonsense about a subject he knows nothing about, because he has then to take the devil's advocate position. He has to argue against the campaigner. So in our experience over 3 years, what happens time and time again is they simply drop the item. If there's some small item about, you know, a fire in a plastics factory in Stunthorpe, that instantly rockets up the news agenda and your item never gets broadcast. However, if you are a think tank and you can present yourself as an independent expert who is going to at least try and put both sides of the story, but in fact it allows you maybe to emphasize one side a bit more than the other, but if you have that status as a think tank independent expert, it means the interviewer isn't discomforted by having to talk technically about a subject he knows nothing about. The producer feels comfortable because he's satisfied his criteria for balance in what must be broadcast. And the result is that the news item gets run, which 9 times out of 10 never would get run. So when I say that FIPA isn't a campaigning organisation, I'm entirely serious, but there is more to that position than meets the eye. Get in contact, then there it is. All right, thanks a lot. Bye bye.